When you think of Daniel, what comes to mind? In our reading this morning, we learn the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. So picture Daniel, from a high family, a social status, physically fit, strikingly handsome, and if Joanna were giving this talk, she might tell you to picture Daniel Craig, whom many, I understand, think is strikingly handsome. Apparently Daniel's actually much shorter than he appears on screen. And so picture someone who looks like Daniel Craig, only more handsome and less dumpy. Daniel is bright. He is quick to understand. He was age 17. He would have achieved A stars in all his AS subjects this week. He'd be heading for Oxford or Harvard in a year's time. His future would be predictable. After university, he would go to medical school or law school or to Sandhurst. He would be working in a few years' time in Harley Street or the diplomatic service or the city or MI5. He would be a stockbroker, a barrister, an officer, an ambassador, or maybe a corporate CEO. He would be successful in whatever he turned his hand to. He would marry a beautiful wife. He would live in an enviable home with the right postcode. He would raise a wonderful family who all went to public schools, and he would occupy a prominent place in the community. And he would also do good things for God and God's people. But life did not turn out the way Daniel had planned. There's a whole world of heartbreak in the first two verses of Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. The heartbreak is this. God had promised a long time ago to Abraham, I will be your God and your people. They will be my people, and I will give you the promised land, and I will make you a new community that will bless the whole world. The promise had sustained the people of Israel through centuries. At times, they had been up and they'd been down. They'd been in slavery in Egypt for many centuries. They'd been delivered under Moses. They'd wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They went into the promised land, and after a period of time, they reached their peak under Solomon. David and Solomon. Solomon built that glorious temple, and then there was the long, slow decline. For all his wisdom in governing the nation, he had not been a good father. The kingdom became divided. The 10 tribes of the northern kingdom were defeated. The people driven into exile, never to return. All that left was the southern kingdom, Judah. And then when Daniel was a young man, with the world at his feet, Nebuchadnezzar, a foreign king, came to Jerusalem and with very little effort besieged it, destroyed all that was left of God's dream and Daniel's. The temple became a memory. Daniel would spend the rest of his life, 70 years or more, as an exile in a foreign land. He would give his best years to a foreign king. He lost his culture. He lost his family, he lost his friends, and he had to learn a foreign language. He would live and die in a foreign country. He would never go home. And the greatest indignity of all, he would lose his name. This name deal is quite significant. In verse 7, we're told that Daniel and his friends were given new names. The old Hebrew names were a derivation of the name of God. Either that little symbol El, as in Daniel, Mishael, comes from Elohim, and the syllable Yah as in Hananiah, Azariah, from Yahweh. Their names, therefore, gave evidence of their relationship to the one true God. Their names reminded them they belong to God. That's why Nebuchadnezzar gives them new names. It's his way of saying you serve a new God, a new king. The name Daniel means the Lord will judge. It's a good name. The Lord will be my judge. Through his childhood, every time he heard his name called by his mother or his father, it was a reminder of the Lord. The Lord would be his judge. But he's not Daniel anymore. The Lord is not setting things right. In fact, it looks like his promises have failed. The Lord is not his judge. He's certainly not the judge of the Babylonians. So maybe you can identify with Daniel today. Maybe you feel like you've ended up in Babylon. In fact, if you don't think you're living in Babylon, look more closely at your circumstances. But what do you do when you realize you've ended up in Babylon? Because sooner or later, we do. Because Babylon is where you find yourself when life does not turn out the way you planned. Maybe a relationship or a marriage of your dreams has ended. Maybe your vocational hopes have died. Maybe someone you love has wounded you deeply. Maybe you realize that deep prayer that's cherished you for years will never be answered the way you want. Welcome to Babylon. Cut off from the life you planned on, you now realize you'll never go home. And worst of all, maybe you think God doesn't care. How could God allow this to happen? Has he forgotten his promise? Does he even notice? What do you do when you find yourself, like Daniel, in Babylon? Because there's a whole field of research into this kind of suffering or trauma. The clinical term is depression, or in a more serious form, post-traumatic stress disorder. Something dies inside. You lose the will to live. But studies show that there are some people, they don't just survive these traumatic experiences, they don't simply endure, they adapt, they're creative, and they flourish through the trauma. Researchers call these people resilient. They call this capacity to thrive resiliency. And tonight, come to our evening service, we're going to meet Wes Stafford, and we're going to hear his story, his personal story of resilience. Researchers have concluded that there are certain characteristics, identifiable qualities of spirit, that mark out resilient people. And as we read Daniel's story, we're looking at one of the most resilient people in history. As we've said, in his youth he lost everything. He lost his home, his family, his future, even his name. And yet with God's help, in Babylon, Daniel learned not just to survive, but to thrive. In the time we've got this morning, I want us to meet Daniel in Babylon and observe three of the characteristics that make for spiritual resiliency. And the first is that resilient people resolve to maintain their integrity. Resilient people resolve to maintain their integrity. Notice in verse 8. Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. The first observation we can make about resilient people is that they resolve. They make a decision of the will to honor their deepest values. They refuse to live as victims of circumstances beyond their control. They refuse to compromise. They refuse to betray their deepest values. They resolve in the will to honor God. Now, in many ways, verse 8 is the hinge, not just of chapter 1, but of the whole book of Daniel. The whole book of Daniel. Because until verse 8, the Babylonians have determined everything. They're in control. Nebuchadnezzar determines to conquer Israel. He determines to plunder its sacred objects. He conscripts its highest potential citizens. He determines to enroll them in his leadership academy. He decides on the entrance criteria, the subject matter, the diet, and even their new names. They're to be fed rich food from the king's table. And the easiest thing in the world for Daniel would have been to feel like a victim, to get used to it, to bend with the wind, to become compliant, and maybe even enjoy the ride. But no. From verse 8 on, the initiative in the story changes. And the writer shows us in a really colourful way. It's kind of hard to pick it out in most translations, but the same verb gets repeated 3 times. A literal rendering of verse 7 would be, the chief of staff determined new names for them. He determined on Belshazzar for Daniel. But Daniel determined not to defile himself with rich food. It's the same verb repeated, but this time it's Daniel determining. Daniel the captive, Daniel the prisoner, makes a decision. And the writer uses a really strong word to reinforce what's happening here. Daniel resolved in his heart he would honour God, he would not defile himself. He simply makes a decision. But it's a decision that has a knock-on effect that transforms his life. Everyone was on the Atkins diet. You know, roast beef, steak, ham, eggs and cheese. Daniel wants to join Weight Watchers. The text doesn't say why this food would defile Daniel, probably because it had been offered to an idol. Maybe it was not kosher. It was certainly from the king's table. But it's clear that Daniel knew he needed to draw a line. He needed to take a stand. And we know that it took much courage on Daniel's part. Nebuchadnezzar was not the kind of king to give people much latitude. In 2 Kings 25, a puppet king called Zedekiah rebels. Nebuchadnezzar captures Zedekiah and his family. He lines up his sons in front of Zedekiah. He slaughters all his sons in front of him, and then he gouges out the eyes of Zedekiah. The last thing he sees is his sons being killed. You've heard of leaders with a hands-on or hands-off management style. Nebuchadnezzar was a heads-off management style. If you crossed him, he cut off your head. I wonder if you have a really tough boss. Well, imagine working for a boss so tough, he doesn't just terminate people, he terminates people. That's Nebuchadnezzar. That's who Daniel is dealing with here. But Daniel determines something. He remembers his name. He doesn't view himself as a victim or a pawn. He resolves in his heart with courage and determination that he will take a stand. That's what makes spiritually resilient people. They resolve to honour God, whatever the consequences. They don't accept the excuse that life is beyond their control. They seize whatever initiative is available to them, and they act. He goes to the dean of the school with a request. And the dean says, if I say yes to you, you're going to end up looking weak, you'll lack energy, and I'm going to lose my head as well. Well, Daniel says to himself, well, that's not exactly a yes, but it's not exactly a no. So he goes to the next in line in the organizational chart, the guard, and he says, let's try this diet thing for 10 days, and then you be the judge. He exercises initiative, courage, and faith that God is going to work. And God does. In fact, by verse 16, the guard is so impressed with Daniel and his friend's health that he takes everyone off the Atkins diet, and he puts them all on Weight Watchers. And Daniel goes to the head of the class. But notice, it only happens when everything looked like it was lost and Daniel resolved in his heart that he would not betray his deepest values. He resolved in his heart he would honour God. He wouldn't give up his integrity. He would do the right thing. So let me ask you whether you feel like you've compromised this week. The husband, like Tiger Woods, who never intended to lose his family, but decided it was okay to flirt with adultery. The business person who decides that cutting the ethical corner here and there will make a ride to the top quicker. Most people never intend to wreck their careers or shatter their reputation or destroy their marriage. They think they can get away with it. Before they know it, they suffer a crash that wrecks their life and others. But invariably, it begins in more subtle ways, like their diet. It can be hurry. It can be success. It can be a deception. It can be a compromise, a white lie, You may see yourself as a helpless victim, a pawn of circumstances beyond your control, trapped by decisions made by others, and you think there's nothing you can do about it. Wrong. God is calling you to be like Daniel today. Make a resolution in your heart that will take courage and wisdom to carry out, because you can do it. That is how spiritual resilience grows. You exercise the muscle. This is required if you're going to survive in Babylon. So today, regain your integrity, do the right thing. This is the only life you've got. It's your day. You get one shot at tomorrow. So what are you going to resolve differently tomorrow in your heart? If it's a relationship you need to end, end it. Do you need to repent of unethical business practices? Repent and set things right first thing Monday morning. You need to reorder your time? Reorder it. If there's some area of your life where you need to be proactive and you haven't because you've seen yourself as a victim, stop wallowing and take responsibility. Tomorrow does not have to be like yesterday. You must resolve in your heart. Now let's get this in perspective. Why was this so important to do the right thing over his diet? In the future, Daniel and his friends would have much more difficult decisions to make. There was one point where they were commanded to bow down and worship the king or be thrown into the furnace. And they hear themselves say, okay, throw us into the furnace because we're not going to bow down. Daniel will be told one day, cease praying to your God or you'll be thrown to the lions. And Daniel says, throw me to the lions because I'm not going to stop praying. See the link? If Daniel and his friends had not drawn the line over their diet and seen God honor them, they would not have had the spiritual resiliency to withstand the threat of the fire and the lions. So resolve today, I will honor God, I will not hand over this one and only life God has given me to any power in Babylon, to any person, any relationship, any job, any boss, any habit, any force, or any schedule. I'll resolve in my heart that I will honor God. Because resilient people resolve to maintain their integrity. Secondly, resilient people commit to build their community. Notice verses 17 to 19. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. For Daniel, he found strength in a little, small group that formed with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we're going to see these characters again in the story. It was really a small group, a Bible study group, perhaps, because they ate together, they went through college together, they studied together, they prayed together, and they faced decisions together. And having been tested, they would one day help to rule together. By God's grace, this small group of devoted believers would change the course of an entire civilization. When you live in Babylon, you will not survive and thrive alone. You just won't, because God never intended us to live in isolation. That was the point of Paul's analogy in Romans. Julia Siegel, one of the primary researchers in this area, wrote this. He said, few captives suffered more than Vice Admiral James Stockdale, who served 2,714 days as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. On one occasion, his captor shackled his arms and legs and left him in the glaring sun 3 days while he was beaten repeatedly to keep from sleeping. After one beating, he heard a towel snapping out in code that the prisoners of war had devised a message he would never forget. 5 letters. G-B-U-J-S. 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 God bless you, Jim Stockdale. Siegel writes that for those prisoners of war, the briefest experiences of community, of being connected, was literally a life or death deal. Their devotion and ingenuity in creating community happened in spite of unbelievable obstacles. If one man walked by another cell, he would drag his sandal in code to send a message. Men sent messages to their comrades through the noises they made, shaking out their blankets, belching, snoring, blowing their noses. Isn't it ironic that when community is difficult, people will move heaven and earth and risk their lives just for a moment of it? But when community is so available, like on Sundays, we take it for granted. Let's value our church family breakfast next Sunday. Let's value the fourth Sunday lunches we have together, because community, that is deep friendship, spiritual intimacy, does not come easy. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be open. You have to be looking to the other. That is why our membership covenant as a church is a covenant with one another before God, that by God's grace, we will determine not to neglect one another, but support and uphold one another. So we're going to find out tonight, too small to ignore, why the least of these matter most. The least of these matter most. So I'm going to ask you, are you in community? Do you have a small group, a trusted Christian brothers and sisters that support you, a prayer triplet, a small group? And if I hear you say, no, I tried once and it didn't work out, then try again. Try again. In the next few weeks, we're going to be relaunching our home groups, our Bible study groups that meet weekly or fortnightly around the community for Bible study, for prayer and fellowship. That's why we have our first Wednesday, to meet together collectively to pray and to learn and to share. And there are people sitting maybe on your right or your left who are in need of community. I wonder if you realize what a difference it makes to hear you say, God bless you, or I'm praying for you, or it's good to see you, I've missed you, or your life really counts. People need to hear that code, GBU, not just hostages and prisoners of war. People in this room need to hear the code. As community, we must ensure that nobody leaves church on Sundays without hearing someone say, I'm glad you're here, you matter to me, don't give up. How do we learn to thrive in Babylon? Resilient people resolve to maintain their integrity. Secondly, resilient people commit to build community. And thirdly, resilient people remember that life, even their suffering, has meaning and purpose in the eyes of God. Verses 20, 21. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. It's very interesting. Researchers say that the factor that causes people to give up most is not when their suffering gets too intense. It's when they believe that their suffering has no point, no meaning, no purpose. It's not the intensity, but the meaninglessness of it. Someone's done some research into suicide notes, and they rarely speak of failing health, rejection, finances, or even physical pain. They say things like, there's no point in going on. There's no reason for me to keep on living. See, Daniel was about to discover something in Babylon he could never have known if he'd spent his whole life in Israel as planned. He discovers that there is another character in the story besides Daniel and his friends. He discovered it when the diet worked, and he discovered it progressively as the story unfolds. See this in reverse. Verse 17. To these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning. Now look at verse 9. Now God had caused the officials to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. Now look at verse 2. The Lord delivered Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. The writer is convinced that God is in control from the very beginning. He has a purpose for what is happening every step of the way. He knows what many of the Israelites didn't know. He's convinced that even the defeat of Judah, the loss of their temple, deportation to Babylon that looked so tragic, was not random, it was not meaningless. God is not asleep, he's not broken his promise, he's not forgotten his dream. God is up to something in Babylon, in the place of suffering. God, as it turns out, loved even the Babylonians. He had a purpose for Nebuchadnezzar too. Whatever you're suffering today, or tomorrow or sometime in the future, remember God is with you wherever you are, whatever Babylon you find yourself in. Next week, when we revert back to the 9:30 and the 11 o'clock service at 9:30, we're going to begin a series in Nehemiah. We're going to see what happened to God's people after Babylon, after Daniel. God's providential grace working his purposes out, bringing them back into the land to prepare for the day when the Saviour of the world would be born. This morning we've been thinking about Daniel and his determination. Three lessons we've learned. Resilient people commit, resolve to maintain their integrity. Resilient people commit to build community. Resilient people remember that life has a purpose.